This week on The Right Side, Alberta's NDP government released a fiscal update that looked rosy, but is not. The NDP government in BC created an electoral reform survey to sway the opinion despite appearing neutral. And we cover Finance Minister Morneau's continuing clash with ethics. This is The Right Side, episode 45, recorded Saturday, December 2nd, 2017, The Ethics of Deception. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of The Right Side. Patrick and myself are here, as we are each and every week.
It's good to be back with all of the news that we've had this week.
A little bit of a quieter news week this week than some weeks, but oh boy, do we have stuff to talk about. For those of you guys joining us for the first time, this is The Right Side, a podcast where we aim to cut through all the bias and sensationalism that you find in the news, the mainstream news, online, on TV, in newspapers, and the like. So that's what we're here to do, and we do this every week at rightsidenews.ca with full show notes if you want to follow along. We got some really interesting stories this week, Alberta, BC, and a firing line. So we're just going to jump right on into that with the big news out of Alberta this week, and that is the province's fiscal update. So on Tuesday, the NDP government released their fall fiscal update, and this isn't a budget. It's mainly just a progress of how we're going with the budget at this point in time. But the fall fiscal update shows that Alberta still has a $10.3 billion deficit compared to what was forecast to be $10.4 billion at budget time. The government has also signaled that they want to rein in spending and reduce the amount of people in the public service through attrition, which effectively means they want to shrink the size of government. Which, have we ever heard of an NDP government saying that they wanted to rein in spending and reduce the size of the public service?
And using the word attrition is quite interesting as well, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, because that basically means we're not going to hire any new public service workers. And of course, that's what the NDP is all about, and that's what they have been doing since they came to power in 2015. But we'll talk more about that in just a moment. They also want to implement a hiring freeze across government, as well as zero salary increases for everyone, including the public sector unions. So that, of course, means the nurses and the teachers in the next round of negotiations with those stakeholders, which, again, that's something very odd to see coming from an NDP government. It's almost as if they're pulling the playbook right out of the opposition and what the opposition would be doing if they were in power. Though with all this being said, the government still plans to balance their budget somehow by 2023, Finance Minister Joe Cece said this week. And along with this, the government will continue to borrow to the tune of $9.3 billion for capital projects. That's investments in roads, infrastructure, schools, hospitals, etc. this year. And this also includes operations, that is funding the day-to-day operations of government. This means that the debt this year is set to rise above $42 billion, considering that prior to the NDP's election, and I think it was 2014, we first started accumulating debt once again. It's just rocketing up right now at this point. Now, there's also something really strange about this fiscal update, and that is that the government kept its price of oil forecast at $49 a barrel, when over the last 6 months or so, the price of oil has been hovering at around $58 US per barrel, which of course plays a huge role into how large the budget deficit appears to be. So there was some thinking that, you know, if the government can delay updating the forecast price for oil closer to the end of 2018 and perhaps early into 2019 at this point next year, it sets them up for a good point into the next election where it looks as though that they are actually reducing the budget more so than they are. And, you know, this is a simple work with the numbers kind of game that they're playing. The former PCs used to do this all the time, even changing the way budget deficits were reported to focus only on operational spending. But the fact they're keeping the price of oil at roughly $9 lower than it is actually right now, when they could safely raise it up to $53 or $54 a barrel for their forecast price to make the books look better this year kind of shows that they're thinking around to the next provincial election, which is slated to be in 2019, but who knows, it could be sooner because stranger things have happened here in Alberta before. Following from this this week, Alberta's credit rating was once again downgraded by DBRS from AA from AA high with, quote, all trends negative. And for anyone wondering what this means, this basically means that the province's ability to borrow money it now costs them more to do that because of our current fiscal outlook here in the province. And there doesn't appear to be any reasonable path back to either getting rid of the deficit or, more importantly, reducing the debt here in Alberta. And anyone knows who has a credit card that the more debt you have, the harder it becomes for you to gain capital and you have to pay more on that debt. And that is currently the situation that Alberta is in right now. And it just means that there's more being spent on debt payments that could ultimately be spent on paying for services for everyday Albertans. So debt is very bad. And, you know, that is perhaps one of the things that was overlooked a lot in the initial reporting of this fiscal update by the mainstream media. Because when this report came out, not only were they talking about the fact that the budget deficit was about $100 million less than it was anticipated to be, but also that unemployment had improved, more on that in just a couple of seconds, there was very little talk on the first day until the credit rating downgrade about the amount of debt that the province was accumulating. So overall, what started off looking like a decent fiscal update has turned out to be pretty bad, both from the debt perspective and also the unemployment rate. Now, the report, the fiscal update report, also talks about the unemployment rate falling to 7.3%, which is the lowest level in 2 years since the recession. All right, that might look like it's a good bullet point for the government, and, you know, they talked about it and the media talked about it, but it wasn't until later in the week that the numbers were delved into further, and specifically in a piece in the Globe and Mail, it was reported that, you know, this isn't exactly the unemployment rate decreasing, it is the fact that our population has increased, and even with the population increasing, the unemployment rate has fallen largely due to people who have stopped looking for work. And it might not be immediately apparent to everyone, but unemployment rate is actually calculated based on the number of people who are unemployed divided by the total number of people who are actually looking for employment. So if people stop looking for unemployment, but the number of people who don't have jobs remains the same, the unemployment rate will still fall, even though the same number of people aren't working. And that's a little caveat that you sometimes see when it comes to talking about unemployment, but is not always glossed over by the media. So,
and that's why there's the saying that there's three different types of lies. Lies, white lies, and statistics. You have to always look with every statistic. When there's a rate that's being calculated, it's only telling one side of a story.
Exactly.
It's not telling everything.
Exactly. And, you know, that is something that economists need to do better when they talk to the media. They need to underscore that unemployment rate is calculated based on the people that are actually looking for work. And if people stop looking for work, technically they ceased being unemployed, which isn't something that's talked about all that much. So in this Globe and Mail piece, Trevor Tom says that prior to Alberta's recession in January of 2015, the employment rate, keep word there, the employment rate was 69.5%. And that fell to 66.1% in July of 2015, once the recession had started. And last month, in 2017, that number was 66.6%. So in the 2.5 years since the recession began and has ended, Alberta's employment rate has only increased by 0.5%. So granted, we see falling unemployment numbers, but the employment rate has only increased by 0.5% and is nowhere near what it was prior to the start of the recession back in January 2015. And this is what you were saying regarding statistics, that if you look at it this way, it paints a completely different picture than what the standard employment rate for the province says. So this is something that everyone needs to start thinking about. And, even though the government says that the unemployment rate is down, the numbers still don't look all too rosy from the employment perspective, which is another major metric to rate what this fiscal update actually brings forward for Albertans. Finally, and perhaps one of the largest indictments of this fiscal update, is a new report this week by the Fraser Institute. That is an economic think tank that is based in BC. And their report surveyed a bunch of oil-producing jurisdictions. And this year, Alberta and BC are the least attractive province for oil and gas investment. BC dropped to 76 of 97 jurisdictions and was 39th last year. And Alberta was ranked number 33 this year, but was ranked at number 14 back in 2014. Now, if you compare other places on the continent about where we can look for good sources of petroleum investment, Texas is number one, Oklahoma number two, and North Dakota number three. Lots of American states in the top 10. Whereas we used to be in the top 20, but we are in the lower half of this report now. So that is also something that we all should be worried about when it comes to talking about the fiscal update. So overall, what seemed like a very rosy fiscal update back on Tuesday when it was reported was slowly chipped away at this week by various media reports. But did you hear any about this in the mainstream media? Probably not. So.
Definitely not over here either.
Yeah, because
especially that Fraser Institute report. It's painting quite the picture for BC as well to be dropping so low for oil and gas investment. But it really does paint the, as you said, paint the picture of what's been going on in the last year or so since the NDP took power here, and with all the energy projects that are now being stalled.
Yeah. And, you know, this also goes into what we talked about a couple of episodes ago regarding signals. And these NDP governments might not be trying to send overt signals that they are not open for business, but their actions are sending the signals, specifically here in Alberta, regarding the debt, the deficit, and the employment rates. That has pushed us down to 33 and BC even further. So it's something we should all be aware of. And it would have been great to have this kind of report as part of the actual fiscal update on Tuesday, but I guess we didn't have a credit rating downgrade by then to kick the rest of the plan into motion. So, all right. So we'll have to watch and see what happens this spring, and if things get better on the employment numbers and the debt numbers specifically, because we know they will get better on the budgetary numbers, because all they need to do is increase the estimate for price of oil. So I think that takes us nicely into BC, since we were just talking about the NDP. What have the NDP been up to there?
Yeah, so back a month ago on episode 40, I was talking about the BC NDP and the BC Green plan to hold a referendum on electoral reform. You might remember back during the election, that was a key plank of both of their electoral platforms. And it's back in the news as a press conference was held just outside the legislature about it. NDP MLA Bob Deeth and Green MLA Sonia Furstenow announced a, quote, working group to engage British Columbians about democracy in advance of the referendum next fall. Now, you might remember back on episode 40, I talked about how it's being scheduled for November of next year. That's just under a year away from now. So the referendum will ask whether BC should switch to a proportional representation voting system for electing MLAs, which the Greens and NDP both badly want. That's because the system could dramatically boost the number of Green MLAs, which allows them to continue their governing partnership with the NDP and then freeze the BC Liberals out of power. Now, it's clear that both the NDP and the Greens want the referendum to succeed because they're setting the bar as low as possible for the referendum to succeed. In both earlier electoral referendums, the government required a 60% yes for the referendum to pass. A supermajority of constituencies was also needed, requiring a majority yes vote in 60% of the ridings to prevent regional dominance and to ensure that there's a clear public mandate. However, as Furstenow says, quote, we consider 50% plus one to be a majority of British Columbians. And in saying so, she's actually forgetting that not 100% of British Columbians will be voting in the referendum. For example, if voter turnout is just 50%, that means only a quarter of voting age British Columbians will be the deciding factor. And a vote turnout threshold is also not required for this referendum. She says, quote, "A system where 40% of the vote can give 100% of the power to one party is not an effective representation of democracy." And while, yes, that is true, it should also be noted that a referendum where 25% of the people can change that entire democratic system for 100% of the population, and apparently that is just fine to them, even though it shouldn't be, according to her quote, right?
Absolutely.
Now, what's worse is that the NDP are actually feigning neutrality on this referendum, when it's clear that they're anything but. They've created an online survey through the official BC government website that asks pointed questions such as, quote, "Which, if any, of the following have been barriers that have kept you from voting?" And a question to see if the number of MLAs should increase or stay the same. Nowhere is there an option, of course, to decrease the number of MLAs, because clearly the NDP doesn't believe in smaller government. Now, Attorney General David Eby says he hopes supporters and opponents of the change don't try and hijack the online survey. He said, quote, "This isn't a poll. This isn't a vote. This is a consultation with British Columbians, so I'd really discourage those groups from viewing this as a way to have all their members provide the same answer." Now, the online survey itself can be read as steering public opinion toward a favorable view of the NDP preference for proportional representation. But in justifying the contents last week, Attorney General David Eby cited the, quote, "assistance of a quartet of academic advisors who, quote, reviewed the questionnaire." But he won't actually release details in how those advisors shaped the questionnaire or who they are.
I don't think they did shape the questionnaire. Question three, which, if any, of the following have been barriers that have kept you from voting? First option, don't like the voting system.
Exactly, right? So yeah, now the plan is to conduct two surveys, one of which is the online questionnaire I was just talking about that any member of the public can answer, and the second one involves an online panel assembled by the Ipsos polling firm. Quote, "The Ipsos online panel will be made up of 1,000 citizens from around the province of varying age, gender, and ethnicity, who will respond to the questionnaire to ensure that the government hears the views and perspectives of people beyond just those who have chosen to take the questionnaire. The panel helps ensure that survey samples accurately reflect the makeup of the broader population based on census and other reliable data, according to the ministry." So now you're probably wondering if the ministry will release complete breakdowns of the data collected from the two surveys. That would, of course, allow academics and others to analyze the responses and to decide to what degree they support the conclusions drawn by the government. Not a chance. Instead, the NDP will prepare the analysis from the surveys, compile a summary report with recommendations, and present that to the Attorney General. He will then review and approve the report, and then that report will be made available to the public. Yeah, so basically, Eby approved the questions, and then Eby will sign off on the conclusions and recommendations to Cabinet. Then, having presided over the input, he will recuse himself from cabinet debate and decisions regarding the referendum. Now, the recusal is part of the NDP insistent that Eby can serve as a, quote, "neutral arbiter of the process," a claim that, of course, looks more dubious every day. He says, quote, "I have a unique role in this referendum process, to be neutral between the sides as best as possible in preparing this referendum," he claimed at the outset of Wednesday's question period, before dropping the pose of neutrality in favor of a full-fledged partisan attack against the BC Liberals' previous referendums. It's the kind of stuff that gets tossed back and forth between government and opposition on a daily basis, of course, but it's not the standard of conduct for what you would call a self-proclaimed neutral arbiter.
Especially one that's recused himself.
Exactly, especially one who's recused himself, even though he has his fingers in every step of the process. And he also had the temerity to claim that his consultation process was being done, quote, "in a fully transparent way." This, of course, from the minister who won't release the input of the academics who signed off on the survey, nor commit to releasing all the data that will be assembled for independent scrutiny. So the claim of transparency is just as suspect as the notion of EBI as a neutral. Now, be able to draw parallels with the federal liberals, who, of course, have been trying to have their appointment process through a fair and open, transparent process. And they've actually been decried by a lot of others but as being, you know, very much partisan and very much not transparent at all. So it's very interesting here how the NDP here are actually paralleling the federal liberals on this. And as Vaughn Palmer of the Vancouver Sun writes, quote, "That's the problem with the New Democrats on proportional representation. They are so sure that their preferred system is morally superior to the status quo that they have scarce inclination to ensure that a fair, open, and independent process for bringing it about."
And you know, this is, I think, very typical of people of this stripe in this kind of role. They are of the opinion that they know what is best for everyone else involved in the society in this case. And if those people think different than them, they think that either they don't have that the other people don't have the full set of information, or that maybe they might not be able to grasp the full magnitude of what's going on. So I think that is a case of likely what's happening here. And, you know, I believe that when you put it down to it and you look at people are not stupid, and people will see what is in front of them. And for a government and even a justice minister in this case here, the Attorney General, David Eby, to have this kind of attitude regarding electoral reform on this, that is setting up the government for a nasty awakening potentially in the next election if they continue treating the population like this.
And of course, their plan is to make it so that there will never, ever be a nasty awakening, because they are trying to push through this referendum without any consultation, and with the lowest threshold possible as well. So they're counting on people to not know what's going on, and hoping that they'll vote just for something different. Yeah. And now we've seen how votes for something different have happened in Canada recently.
Oh, I think we all know what we're thinking of here.
We could be thinking
Enlighten
about a
us.
Bunch of different things.
Enlighten
right?
us.
Say the vote for change when it comes to the federal election that happened recently, something different, or in Alberta, or in BC, or in many of the other provinces across the country as well. So I mean, it's something that's going to be, we're going to have to look at very closely just to make sure that the NDP are following all the rules on this, and which they don't seem to be, and to make sure that they're being as open and transparent as possible. And I'll be able to follow that up in following weeks as well as we get more information.
All right. Sounds good. Well, speaking of other examples of change or purported change that happened in 2015, we're going to jump onto our firing line segment. And we're looking at Bill Morneau once again in this case, the Finance Minister of Canada. The headline in this case earlier in the week was Bill Morneau threatens to take the Tories to court over ethics allegations. So the ethical issues for our Finance Minister, Bill Morneau, continue to escalate further this week than they have in previous weeks. We've talked about before about the various conflict of interest cases being investigated by the Ethics Commissioner in Ottawa. And one of those, of course, relates to Bill Morneau and his family company, Morneau Chappelle. Previously, Morneau was under fire for not placing his assets in a blind trust once he became finance minister. And basically, a blind trust is an accounting agreement that ensures that someone who has a good amount of assets and someone who's going to be in a powerful position can't directly control those assets while they're in that powerful position to benefit themselves. So this is what a number of government officials did. The prime minister did right off the bat, but Bill Morneau did not. So the questions about ethics, honesty, and transparency have ultimately led to further examination of Bill Morneau. So this week in question period, Bill Morneau was asked by conservative finance critic Pierre Poilievre if he sold 680,000 of his shares in Morneau-Chapelle a week before the finance minister tabled legislation that raised the tax rate on corporations back in December 2015. During the back-and-forth questioning, Morneau didn't answer the question, but simply deflected. This really should have been a simple yes or no answer for the finance minister, because anyone who does some digging will be able to find the appropriate stock transaction records on this and see what Bill Morneau was actually doing during that time. The answer by Bill Morneau was instead to accuse Pierre Poilievre of libel and slander, and threatened to take the Conservatives to court. Now, MPs have the right within the House of Commons chambers to say whatever they want without consequence under something that is known by parliamentary privilege. This basically means that, you know, libel and slander laws, as would apply outside and to the rest of us, don't necessarily apply inside the House of Commons. Now, Bill Morneau dared Poilievre to ask the same question outside at the podium to reporters, and this led to a relatively well-circulated video on social media of Poilievre getting up from his seat and making his way outside. But even though Poilievre did go out there and ask these questions, Morneau was in Toronto at the time of this questioning and didn't really answer the question for this, as even though he dared the opposition to ask the questions outside to the media. Instead, a spokesperson called this absurd and utterly false. Those are the exact words of the spokesperson. This led to some more digging by Global News, and the digging found that Morneau Sr., Bill Morneau's father, sold 100,000 shares on November 23rd, 2015, at $15.20 per share. And another 100,000 shares on December 3rd, 2015, at $15 a share. 4 days after that last transaction is when Finance Minister Morneau tabled the documents which would change the tax rules for wealthy Canadians starting January 1st, 2016. John Iveson from the National Post also commented in one of his columns this week that his notes confirm that there was a trade of this magnitude on December 3rd, 2015, completed by Bill Morneau as well. So here we have a columnist in the National Post effectively confirming what Bill Morneau has said that, or rather has been deflecting around for this entire time period. And you might be wondering why all this is important. Well, according to the past financial data from that time period, the shares fell from $14.90 on December 7th to $14.09 1 week later. That's a drop of about 5.4%. Meanwhile, the comparison for the Toronto Stock Exchange, that entire stock index, dropped by just 2.4% over that same time period. Asked on Thursday in the House of Commons if anyone knew about this, Bill Morneau made the claim that no one else outside the finance minister and his department knew what was on the horizon. And now if you look at this, this is all very important. Because if these allegations are ultimately proven in court, either just Finance Minister Morneau or both Morneau and his father would potentially be guilty of insider trading. Now, Global News has actually done some decent investigative reporting on this issue, highlighting the appropriate stock transaction documents, and they must be commended for it. However, over the past week, we have also seen other headlines asking, quote, is the worst finally over for Bill Morneau? Investigations of this magnitude take time, and this has only just begun. Recall that throughout 2015, the media was all too content to cover the Mike Duffy trial, so much so that stands were brought in for the media outside of the courthouse. That purported scandal ultimately began with just a $90,000 personal payout from Nigel Wright to cover Mike Duffy's Senate expense irregularities. As a result of that, we saw a constant hammering regarding ethics for months, and here instead, we now have a new government with a senior minister potentially engaged in insider trading, and the media is all ready for the story to move on. Now, one final note on this. Recall that the last time that the Liberals were in power, they were taken down by the sponsorship scandal, which was Liberal Party money going to fund activities in Quebec to buy votes. Now, the hypocrisy and elitism on stage here are the same ingredients that led to the downfall of the last Liberal government and are nothing like the real change platform that Trudeau campaigned on in 2015. And by not forcing Morneau to step aside, this means that the Prime Minister either believes Morneau's public stance on the issue, or he has been told that the trading statements are true by Morneau himself and sees nothing wrong with it. Now, if the latter proves to be true, we have a serious ethical problem with this government, and that is what should be the focus of the media on this story.
Yeah, I agree completely there. And just the simple questioning that he's been taking in question period for basically the past 2 weeks, he's basically been hammered by all members of the Conservative Party on this issue, and he still hasn't been able to answer the simple question. He did say that he directed someone working on his behalf to sell the shares, but he didn't say when it happened or when that direction took place. So it's very clear that at some point he did actually sell shares.
Oh, right? Yeah. I mean, Global News and John Iveson have proven that. I don't know why he's still dancing around the issue. I mean, unless it would make him guilty.
I think he's dancing around the issue because he doesn't want to say in the House of Commons, he doesn't want to prove himself guilty. So he's basically been deflecting, and he's been trying to counterattack the Conservatives based on this as well. And you'll see that both Morneau and Prime Minister Trudeau, and also the parliamentary secretary to the Minister of Finance, who is called Joel Lightbound, he answers questions on Morneau's behalf when they're being directed to the Minister of Finance. He's also been saying that they're patently false and whatnot. And then whenever he's asked about the ethics concerns, Lightbound, he also just goes back and says, he talks about the finance minister's record and how he's helped the economy and helped people find jobs and, you know, the same old raising taxes on the highest 1% and lowering them for the middle class. It's the same talking points that we get from the Liberals all the time on the issue. So basically, he's not answering the question in the House of Commons, and he probably won't be, no matter how much he's asked about it. Now, the reason why I think that the Conservatives are asking the questions so many times is they're trying to keep it within the public discourse.
Yeah.
They're trying to keep people talking about it because
exactly.
That's the only way they can do it if the media doesn't want
to
talk about
it. And that's not going to happen this week because Trudeau is leaving for China on December 3rd through the 6th. And that's going to be the main focus this week.
Oh, yeah. And the problem is that when they're talking about Morneau all the time, they're actually not talking about all the other things that the Liberals are doing this week. There's been a few cases of, you know, where they're talking about all the appointments process that they're making and that they're trying to force through appointments under the cloud of all this that's going on with Morneau. And there's a lot of things that they're doing that are wrong right now. And who knows if the courts can actually prove if Morneau was guilty of this or not. But
yeah, and you know, you don't need a guilty verdict in this. You just need the specter of a senior minister going to a potential court case on this, or even someone in the minister's family, because where would his dad get the information from?
Exactly.
So, you know, this is something that has the potential to drag on for months, but I have a feeling based on how the media works, we won't be seeing that. It's a serious ethical issue, and it just really proves that nothing has changed from 2005 with this party. So, anyways, that takes us nicely into our word of the week, and the word of the week this week is ethics. This is defined as the moral principles that govern a person's behavior or the conducting of an activity. The discipline with having to deal with what is good and bad and with the moral duty and obligation. So, as we can see here, we have a great example here of ethics in our firing line, how Bill Morneau and I think the Prime Minister as well are just constantly skirting the bounds of what is ethical for a government. I think that's reasonable to say. We also have the ethics of David Eby attempting to be an impartial arbiter, recusing himself but having his fingers in the process. And finally, the ethics in Alberta of mounting debt, credit downgrades, and whether or not that is ethical to be putting on to the future of this province. So ethics is something we can talk a lot here about on this episode of The Right Side, but ultimately when it comes down to it, ethics have been skirted all around Alberta, BC, and Canada this week. And that is not something that you heard in the mainstream media. So hopefully this has been insightful to you for this episode of The Right Side. All right. I believe that finishes off our show this week.
I think so as well.
Well, if you guys want to find full show notes, you can find that at rightsidenews.ca. We're also on iTunes and YouTube at rightsidenews.ca/iTunes and /YouTube. And we're also on social media on Twitter and Facebook at rightsideca. That being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of The Right Side.
And we will always be here to give you the full unvarnished truth of what's going on in the mainstream media and with our governments. And we will always try and strive to cut through the bias and sensationalism. So with that said, we will see you next week for another episode of The Right Side.